The honest question that I want to ask you guys, and I want to crowdsource, is this question: why don't we evangelize? Why don't we evangelize? Now, notice it's a little bit of a loaded question, right? It's a little bit of a loaded question. It assumes that we're not. Now, maybe you personally are evangelizing, but so this is a bigger question: why do Christians in general resist evangelizing? Yeah, Amanda.
Maybe sometimes we just don't have all the knowledge. Sometimes we think we need to study up on the opposite end of things, so we can have the prepared answers for what we are. Because a lot of Christians in the church, we aren't necessarily the best at improvising sometimes, and so we trip over our own words, and we might be afraid that maybe somebody might try to challenge us, but really they're just doing what they're doing. They're contradicting against us because their belief contradicts against our belief, and then they might say something that we don't know much about. We trip over our own words, and then that person walks away thinking they won an argument or a conversation, and they just carry on with their lives, and we end up walking away feeling like we didn't do the Lord's work at all, and that person is never going to be saved. So we can confuse ourselves.
So I think, Amanda, for those listening maybe on here, Amanda's basically saying we talk ourselves out of it because we think we're not equipped. Mm-hmm. We think, I'm not going to be able to answer their question. I'm not going to be able to shoot down every false thing that they say, that kind of thing. Calvin.
I think another answer would be a very primitive one. Elementary, I would say, and that is, we're afraid of what other people think.
We're afraid of what this person will think of us?
Or, yeah. Mm-hmm. And what his peers may think of us. Mm-hmm. I think that's very, very at the core of it.
Yeah. Eric?
For me personally, two reasons. One, it's hard. And I don't see instant gratification, immediate fruit. Mm-hmm. I've had conversations with people for years, and it can get discouraging because I'm like, you know, I've answered all your questions, now believe.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's hard, and it's discouraging to keep trying. You don't want to keep trying. You know, sometimes you just want to give up on the person, right, in some sense. Yeah, Dodie.
Sharing really intense. I don't see. Sometimes there's an opportunity to slip something in, but I don't sit there and I'm concerned about getting something better. Not okay. Am I going to, you know, share the gospel with these people?
Yeah. Like, when am I supposed to have time to do this?
That's a good set. I mean, that's kind of like what I think is like, when am I really going to have time to share? And there's times when things do open up. I do have patients that are Christian, and I can share with them a little bit, or there's opportunities where I can extend some of compassion and so forth, but I don't have really feel a good sense of, okay, I'm just going to really be able to present the full gospel to anybody. Mm-hmm. And so then I come home, and it's like, I'm tired. I have things to do.
Well, I'm toasted. Right, it's time to sleep.
Yeah. I got a yard to work on, house to clean, all those kind of things, so I just tend to not to take time to go and search for something. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Carl.
There's, for me, it's not knowing who I am speaking to. And you know, I'm a stranger coming up there and telling them this. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is speaking to people who know me. Am I someone who, if you've already seen how I am in the real world, and then I'm going to tell you about Jesus, it's very difficult.
Mm-hmm. So do you, when you say that, you know me, then you mean sort of the, you know, like, if I'll speak for myself, not you, because I don't think you're disappointing, but I'll be like, you know me, you know what a disappointment I am. So now here I am telling you I have good news. Well, I don't even think I'm that exciting of a testimony to the good news, you know. That actually also is an issue in your own family, right? Like, My kids see me walk around the house wearing my tank top with my hair all messed up, and you know, they live with me. And sometimes I think to myself, boy, I hope I'm not scaring my kids off from the gospel, because they see I'm not the guy walking around in the suit and tie all day long. You know, I'm not a very different person, I hope, but I am more disappointing than you people probably realize. Yeah.
Well, I'm still here, so.
Yeah. Thanks, Genesis. Just, I'll keep paying for your car insurance for now. So, Larry.
And talk with on a semi-regular basis, and I've shared the gospel with most of them, but the fear is that I'll overdo it. You know, I don't want to, every time I see them, I want to preach the gospel, because then I'm afraid they'll say, I don't want to talk to this guy, he's got a one-track discussion.
They see you coming around the corner, they make a beeline for the garage. I got something to tinker with in the garage.
So, you know, yesterday I sat down and talked to a couple of guys out in the guy's yard, and I purposely did not bring up, well, I brought up church, used the word church and what was going on, but that was it. And but just because I was afraid to do anything more, because I don't want to scare them away from me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can scare them away from the gospel, but I don't want to scare them away from me. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Gotta have some friends. Can't be chasing everybody off. Right. Yeah, Craig.
I feel like there's a sort of an ethos of live and let live that pervades, I guess, our culture. And also, I think that it's perhaps deceiving. It's like, well, my neighbor seems to be doing okay. So, you know, on a surface level, maybe they don't need the gospel, which is not true. But
we tell all kinds of things to ourselves.
Sure.
Sort of every person that walks by, we go, he's probably like this. He's probably like this. Yeah, Eric.
Just one more thing. Years ago, I heard a sermon about hell, and the pastor simply said, if we as Christians truly believe in hell, the reality of hell, we would tell everybody how to not go there with, you know, zeal and with desperation. And so, you know, for me, it's one of those things where I go, okay, do I really believe enough to want to have the awkward conversation,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, step out of my comfort zone? Where are my priorities at? Comfort or, you know, my belief in something? And even still, it sometimes is. Sometimes isn't enough to motivate.
Yeah, Susan.
I missed the prompting question, but I assume it's what keeps us from sharing the gospel.
Yeah, you got it right.
It seems to me that many people, are not open to the gospel because they don't sense a need. Mm-hmm. And maybe if we're not in the places where people actually sense a need, and we're kind of casting pearls to swine, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
because of what Craig said about this live and let live, that if we were with the, I don't know, in the abortion clinic, or in the, you know, crisis pregnancy council, or the mother, or the mother, children, what is that new facility coming up near my house? What is that? Union Gospel Mission,
mm-hmm.
you know, where homeless mothers and children, their journey home. Places where people are so down and out and life has not worked out for them and everything they've tried in their own human effort has not worked. I feel like we're surrounded in our neighborhood by people who are like, yeah, I've got my life. It's pretty good. I don't really need your religion, but you can have it.
Mm-hmm.
I'll believe in my humanism or the government or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't seem like people sense a need.
Yeah. And that's actually... I mean, we could go back into the Old Testament and look at that, but one of the things like Habakkuk talks about is that in Habakkuk, he talks about the fact that ungodly people are very happy. They tend to have success. They tend to have comfortable things. Actually, in the psalm that we were reading today, he talks about how their bodies are fat and sleek. And I know that that's like such a weird pet phrase. You're just like, what? But I mean, that is the psalmist's way of saying they're healthy. They're feeling good. In other words, if you went to them and said, hey, something's wrong, they'd be like, no, actually, things are fantastic. And so it is particularly hard in a society. I realize that finances are tight, but also we live in an affluent society. So things are, it's affluent in the sense that we're able to be healthy, have homes, vehicles, we're able to have food. There's plenty to eat, right? We're not starving. And you live in a culture like that where all of your bare minimum stuff is taken care of and met. And it is hard for people to believe that something is truly wrong deep down. I'm stealing this from somebody, but I don't remember who I stole it from. They basically said, 1 week of suffering is more productive in the heart of a person than 10 years of comfort. And there is just something about suffering that shakes us, makes us realize that there's something wrong. But if you live in a society that's removed all the rough edges and everything seems to be pretty smooth, or you're not going to the places where there are actually hurting people, it's very easy to convince yourself everything's great. Yeah, Asha.
So I want to think about the underlying motivation in why you would evangelize, not just because we were, you know, pre-commissioned and told to, but I haven't phrased it very well in my brain yet, so I'm just stumbling for the words. Eric talked about the, avoiding hell as kind of your selling point for Christianity. You can talk about the wonders of heaven, how beautiful that's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
You can talk about some sense of peace in your daily life, or maybe being able to overcome some of the sin that you're struggling with any.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally, I've finished studying Revelation for the last whole year. I don't think that heaven and hell are particularly meaningful sell points in our culture today. I think this is just so abstract that I don't think anybody really relates to that. And for the next one, you need to be in a situation of pain where your sin's actually something that's bothering you. So I kind of revert to R.C. Sproul and hit the question that he seems to be coming to in this situation, asking people that are, you know, your affluent neighbors, what do you do with guilt? Because regardless where station in life you're at, this, I don't know, just quoting R.C. Sproul, this seems to be something that nobody can really escape.
Mm-hmm. Even if things are good, what do you do about your guilt?
What do you do with your guilt?
Mm-hmm. I think that's an excellent question to get you into some of those conversations with people. And we'll talk about that some more so we'll start talking too about the ends that we get with people. But some of what I think you're kind of saying is we part of the reason we don't evangelize is we don't even know how to do it. We don't know how to talk about it. And we also lack the motivation sometimes, as Eric was mentioning. And then oftentimes though, we go, how do I even do this? So you're kind of drawing attention to that, which is excellent. I want to talk about a few. I have some contributions on this one. I don't know if they're helpful or not. You can just judge for yourselves. One of the factors I think that keep us from evangelizing is that we do live in a highly individualistic culture. I sort of mentioned this before, but people don't talk to each other. When I was a kid, now this is, let me just preface this. Not only am I old now, you got the gray hairs showing, but I grew up in the Midwest, and I think people may be friendlier in the Midwest. No offense to the Northwesterners. But like when I would go out in town with my grandpa, it was like he would talk to each person that walked by, even if he didn't know him. If they were standing in line, the lady in front of him would like be buying like some oranges or something. And he'd be like, oh, you make an orange juice. If I was in Walmart and there was a lady in front of me buying oranges and I said, oh, you're going to make some orange juice? This is what would happen. I'm getting out of here. Something weird. That guy was just friendly to me. Probably something nefarious, you know. People are just more individualistic. Hey, leave me alone. I don't know you. Why are you talking to me? So people in general don't talk. They don't talk in public. They don't talk to the person standing next to them. They don't talk to the person that's waiting in line with them. They just keep to themselves. That's partly, I think, is at least a social friction that makes it harder to evangelize. Another reason we don't evangelize, we sort of professionalize evangelism. We think there are some people that really know how to do it, right? It kind of goes back to what Amanda was saying, right? Amanda was saying, look, we feel like we're not equipped for this, and we know who is, right? We think it's the professional evangelists. It's the pastors. It's the elders. What people don't know is sometimes we are socially weirder than the rest of you. In fact, you guys know this, actually. You know this, that we are often socially weirder than you. You actually have more social ins with more people than we ever will. I have a social in with all of you. You come here and you want to be here for some reason. And so you want to hear what I have to say for some reason. But you have a lot of people in your life who really care what you think too, in a way they don't care what I think, in a way that they don't care what the elders of our church think. I remember when I was living in Mississippi once, there was a woman whose son was not a Christian. And she said, I want you to come to my house and I want you to meet with my son and I want you to evangelize him. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm dreading this. Complete stranger, doesn't want to come to church, doesn't want anything to do with me or our congregation. And like his mom is going to make him sit down with the pastor for the first time and hear the gospel. And it was as weird and awkward as you would imagine that it was, because here he is meeting a minister for the first time. And the minister's like, so, you know, why don't you go to church? You know, what a fun conversation to have with someone you've just met. And yet he actually had a really important person in his life, which was his own mother. And all of his life, she had been sharing the gospel with him, reminding him of Jesus, telling him about Christ. And sometimes there are just hard hearts. But there, that is something we sort of professionalize it. We think, ah, he's going to have the magic words. He's going to have the really, really skilled gift. And he's going to be able to answer all of the objections and things like that. But generally speaking, members imagine that no one could be better at evangelism than a trained minister. And some ministers actually are amazing evangelists. Some are not as great at evangelism. I would actually put myself in that category, which is why I'm, I think, uniquely equipped to teach this class. Because what am I doing but actually teaching and talking about the very thing I need to be better at practicing and better at doing? And sometimes teaching a subject is a great way to learn it and practice it for yourself. So just know that I'm not going to hold myself up as a paragon of evangelism, and I want God to make me one, though. And I hope all of you want that for yourselves, too. Let me mention another just cultural reason why we may not evangelize here at Evergreen, and here it is. The non-Reformed churches in the area are doing that. And then when those people become Reformed, then they show up here. So we don't have to worry about evangelism because other people are better at it and they'll do it and then they'll come along here. That doesn't really thrill my heart to do it that way. I'm always excited when someone comes here and says, hey, I'm Reformed. I'm looking for a church to go to. And I say, great, that's awesome. Inevitably, you find out that this person got evangelized by another church that is making more efforts to do those things than us. So, hey, you know, we think we don't have to. Our survival doesn't depend on it. And I really want to change our thinking when it comes to that. I do not want to grow a church based on transfer growth. If we're being faithful to the Great Commission, that should not be our plan. I'm not saying we don't mind transfer growth, but don't you want to do more adult baptisms here? Don't you want to have professions of faith, people coming to Jesus for the first time? Don't you want to be having baby Christians in this place where we're discipling them up, raising them up in the faith? They're hearing about Christ. They're bringing their friends. Isn't that what you want? I mean, that is what I want. That's what I want for our church. But to do that, we have to be forced out of our comfort zone. And so we're not evangelistic in part because we think we don't have to be. Another reason is that we sort of prioritize ourselves and our families. This seems to be a strength, right, of our church, but it also is our weakness because we don't put the call to go on the same level as the call to make disciples. We want to make disciples of those who are here already, but the going part is the harder part. It is the part that's more difficult. It's more challenging for us. We're usually good at making disciples. Sometimes we're terrible at going. And then here's one more I'm going to mention, which I'm not accusing us of this, but I am saying this is a reason why we might not evangelize. Instead of a Great Commission mentality, we sort of have a persistent survival mentality. Because I have to admit, when I came to Portland, I thought, all right, what's the importance of this church? And I thought of this church as a hideaway from a radically wild secular culture. And I thought, this is what the church is. The church is sort of our home base, the place where we go, we hide out here, we recharge, we go back out into the world. And that's actually not horrible. I think this church should be seen almost like a monastery. And remember, I'm going back to our evangelism history here. And you remember how essential the monasteries were to going into the culture of Europe. You needed a place that you could go, that you knew the word was going to get ministered. You knew that people were going to get recharged and equipped, and they were going to be able to go back out into the countryside. And it's possible, though, for us to treat the church like a place where we go, we get recharged, we go back out to the countryside, but we don't go out to the countryside to evangelize. We just kind of go out there so we can get through another week. But I want to encourage us as a church that we move beyond having a survival mentality for ourselves and our families. That we instead say, wait, why am I surviving? What is the purpose for which I'm surviving? What is the purpose for which I'm supposed to stay in the faith? Is it just to keep it under to keep this thing and hide it under a bushel basket? Or am I meant to take it to somebody else that's not me? Am I meant to go out into the world, in other words? And that is a shifted mentality. That is a mentality that we often don't carry. And I would say that it might be an underlying motivation. It might be an underlying aspect of why we don't go. Here's another reason. We've seen evangelism done in the past. I mean, if any of you guys have memories of how you've seen other people evangelize before, maybe you've seen that it's very unwelcome, the way that it was done in the past. So Neil Postman, in his book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, talks about this period in American history that we almost can't imagine. It's this period in American history where people loved watching people talk. Like, they found it entertaining to see someone get up and give a speech. They'd be like, gather around, everybody. This man's standing on a corner and has something to say. So then people would gather around. And it was almost like television or radio for us, right? Where we would say, okay, what is he going to do? What's he going to do? And then he would say something, and it would cause a public uproar, and everyone would have a conversation about it. Or Postman uses the Lincoln-Douglas debates as an example. Stephen Douglas and Abraham Lincoln, what do? They just talk for like an entire day, and people are standing there in rapt attention, following every word that they say. And Postman says, this is something that is entirely foreign to us. And he was writing this in the 80s, you know? Postman's funny to read because he's like, who knows, the radio may be the downfall of us all. These newfangled television sets with their pictures coming out of the boxes. And, you know, it's funny to read Postman and you think, oh, what a simple fellow. But everything he's saying is incredibly prescient. He just doesn't think about the fact that we're going to be carrying around those televisions in our pockets and that they will run all day long before they need to be recharged. There is something about our attention spans, in other words, that have been profoundly impacted by the world that we live in now. Postman says this, for one thing, the crowd's attention span would obviously have been extraordinary by current standards. Is there any audience of Americans today who could endure 7 hours of talk? Actually, that's what I'm in for this week when I go to Atlanta. 4 days of just talking for 7 hours a day. So this is, I'm going to come back completely spent. But he says 7 hours of talk or five or three, especially without pictures of any kind. What madness. So not only have people lost their attention spans, but they don't find events like preaching to be entertaining whatsoever. They usually do not find it to be very entertaining. There are other forms of evangelism that people have seen in the past. We think this is how it's supposed to be done. Cold call evangelism. Cold call evangelism, we're Protestants, right? We think, okay, one thing we know is that the people who show up at the door, they're either going to be a Mormon or they're going to be a Jehovah's Witness, and nobody likes that. I've talked about this before. How many of you get a knock at the door, and it's always at 6 o'clock, right, when you're making dinner? But how many of you, just your heart's just alight at the thought that there's someone at my door right now? There are a couple of you extroverts in here, and you probably know who you are, who your soul gets stirred when someone knocks at the door. But everybody else, is their heart sinks when someone comes to the door. It's very rare. I mean, I think in the 80s and 90s, it was not unusual for our family to get random visitors at the door. And my parents would usually spring up and be very excited to go and check the door. But we don't live in that day. And so cold call evangelism, that's what I'm going to call it. Cold call evangelism is just, I didn't ask for this. This person's coming to me. I don't know who they are. I feel like a mark. That's what I know. And so we know that people don't value that kind of thing. And so we kind of shy away from it. I'll give you a personal example of this. We tried it in Mississippi at my church. At my church, Pearl Presbyterian Church, we were nestled into this neighborhood where there were just houses, just hundreds of houses in the neighborhood behind our church. And I remember, like, I talked to the session and I said, I am highly desirous to see the people of this neighborhood come to church. If they're not going here, at least to have them go somewhere, but we should evangelize the neighborhood. And they said, well, you know, we tried that in the past and it didn't work out, but we can definitely try it again. And I remember just being so arrogant, thinking, I'm excited about this. It's going to work. Why? My zeal. My zeal will somehow make this work. And so we had a Saturday where, here's what we did. We had a little packet of information about our church, and we carried them around, and we went to each house, and we would knock on the door. And, you know, there'd be vehicles there. Some of them would even have their door open, their inner door open, and you'd know they were there, but they were hiding until you left. Now, this was probably 2017, so we're not, you know, talking about a century ago, but we're also not talking about something that was just yesterday. I mean, it was 2017. Every house that I went to, either the person would open the door a crack and say, I'm not interested, or they would say, I'm busy right now, I can't talk. It was just house after house of excuses, usually people who were home who didn't come. You know, there's a car in front, you ring the doorbell several times, nothing. We did have one lady who couldn't escape us because she was in her driveway. Ha ha, we caught her. And I had a great conversation with her, but she is on the rolls at a Baptist church somewhere in town. And she hadn't been there in 3 years, she told me, but she's got her name on the rolls. And this kind of was very revelatory to me. I was like, I think I figured out the South. As long as you've got your name on the rolls somewhere, you're good. So we came back from that, though, incredibly discouraged because, you know, we had made this zealous attempt. And yet the thing that we kept running into over and over again was what? They didn't trust us. They didn't trust us. They thought we were going to trick them, or they thought we were going to inconvenience them. They didn't want what we had, or they already thought that they already had what we had for them. And so I think what we've found is a lot of us think, okay, nobody wants that. Nobody wants cold call evangelism. Okay, well, what are we left with? Well, churches will do event evangelism. Max Stiles in the Red Evangelism book, I know it's around here somewhere, Max Stiles talks about event evangelism and about the untold amounts of money and energy and time that a church will put into putting on some kind of an event. Whether that's like a passion play around Easter, or whether that's, you know, some kind of a service that takes place during the Christmas season. But the church will make a huge effort to put these on. And then one of the things Max Stiles talks about is he says, we tell ourselves that it's an outreach event. And then who shows up to the outreach event? We do. We show up for the outreach event, right? We love to see the passion play every year. We love to see the Christmas celebration every year. And it gives us a sense that we are doing something, right? So the presence and the persistence of programs and events can give us sort of an artificial sense that we're doing something. And yet the expense is incredible. The time that people give to it is incredible. And the amount of new visitors to the church that comes from these events is virtually non-existent, because really what we're doing is we're doing it for ourselves. We're doing it for those that are in our circle, Very rarely are these events actually outreach in the sense that is usually intended. And so Max Stiles is very critical of churches that expend thousands and thousands of dollars on these sort of outreaches. The other thing is entertainment-oriented evangelism. So you say to yourself, you know, we're going to do something that's extremely entertaining at our church and it will draw people in. And yet usually what we find is that the church doesn't do the world's music nearly as well as the world. The church usually doesn't do its movies nearly as well as the world does movies. And so when we treat evangelism like a deployment of what the world does, we end up just kind of looking desperate and inauthentic. And if there is anything that people today hate more than desperation, it's inauthenticity, right? You're not being yourself, and they can see it. And so what I want to suggest is what we'll start to do next week, we'll talk about evangelism. Yeah, Eric.
I was just going to say, I don't know who said this, but they said what you win them with is what you win them to. Mm-hmm. And that resonated a lot with me because we, you know, in the past have visited churches that the first 20 minutes, actually this one time, the entire church service was to talk about all their ministries. There wasn't a sermon. There was the worship, and then when you thought it was going to be time for the message, is what they called it, it was 30 minutes of individuals going up and talking about all the different ministries. So yeah, what do you want to know? What do you want to do?
If someone comes to your church because it is so entertaining, they're going to expect you to keep it up. Mm-hmm. You know, otherwise they'll just go somewhere else. So sometimes we think it's the foot in the door. We think the entertainment will be the foot in the door, but it ends up being the persistent thing that is expected now. And it ends up becoming a profound distraction for the church. At least it can be. Yeah, Sue.
Question, though, going back to my previous thing. if we don't have needs-based outreaches, how do we get the foot in the door with people who are hurting? Because if I'm in my little church bubble, my little St. Stephen's bubble, we just moved here in 2018, we have cows and goats and a couple neighbors as neighbors, where am I meeting the Trader Joe's checker and suddenly having a heart-to-heart connection?
Yeah.
So I feel like the only way that I could even be in a position to be ministering on that level where people sense a need is to be actually involved in those needs-based ministries around town.
Mm-hmm. You're singing my
song. In the door, and sometimes churches get criticized for whatever, having celebrate recovery or divorce care or grief care or whatever.
Sure.
But that's where the needy people are coming to you for help.
Yeah. Well, you're singing the song that we are moving toward in the coming week, because the question that really all of us need to be asking is this: if it's not a program that's going to reach a person, and if it's not a massive entertainment event that's going to minister to people, who is supposed to minister to these people? I'm going to crowdsource that question right now. Who is supposed to do it?
The other guy,
me.
Me. Yes, maybe the other guy. Maybe more this one. The other guy might be the thing we were thinking, though.
Not just me.
What Sue has actually brought up, though, is the exact thing I want every single one of us thinking about right now. And because last week I mentioned I want you as your homework. The homework was, does anyone remember what the homework was?
Pray for somebody in your life.
Somebody in your life that you're praying for that needs the gospel, right? And so what I want to do is add to that homework now. I don't want you to drop that homework. I want you to keep praying for somebody in your life. But I also want you to start thinking about this. How is it that I can be exposed to hurting people? What could I be doing that I am not doing that might explain why I'm not running into these folks? Why am I surrounded by people who seem fine? And what would it take to change that? Because what I want us to start doing next week, and we have 2 weeks left, which I said this before, I wish that I did have just like 10 more weeks we could just keep going. And maybe at some point we'll do more. So I'm not just saying this is just the end of the line, but it is the end of the Sunday school season, or we're closing in on it. But I want you to be thinking about this. Evangelism in our day needs to be personal. It cannot be impersonal, and it can't be inauthentic. It can't just be us going to someone and giving them a sales pitch. They see right through it. They don't like it. People don't appreciate it. And I would suggest this. That means that evangelism takes more time. It takes more intentionality. It takes more purpose on our part. It takes more investment from us. And it takes us actually being in somebody's life so that they don't feel like we're doing a drive-by on them. Instead, they know us and they know that we care. And so I'm giving you a little bit of a preview of where we're going with this in the next 2 weeks. But we need to get ready to be in people's lives. And that's asking a lot of us. Dodi mentioned it before. People are very busy. People's lives are very filled with a lot of things. And yet we still have a call to go, don't we? We still have that call. And so I want us to just sort of, even now, I'm trying to plant the seeds for us to be thinking about what we ought to be doing different than we're doing now. And I would love for you guys to come back with that next week. So when we return to this class, let's talk about that and let's go from there. Yeah, Charlie.
A very simple thing that Nathan Lewis shared years ago was there's all these random people that we have brief encounters with, like checkers in the grocery store. He suggested intentionally going through the same checkers line every time and gradually develop a relationship. And just little things like that. I was embarrassed yesterday. I went to get my wife a coffee before I took off on a trip. And the clerk at the coffee hut said, "Oh, you're Daniel Meeker's dad." "I recognize the drink," she said. So
you're the only guy that gets pickle juice in his coffee.
She's connecting people that she sees regularly, and I've now realized I've probably seen that woman several times and don't even know her name.
Well, and that's an area that I've got some personal illustrations that I can share when it comes to that. Just talking about that repetition, seeing the same people, that sort of thing. But I'll save it for next week. In the meantime, please be thinking about this. I would be really excited just to know that everyone in this room is thinking about evangelism this week, looking around and praying for opportunities. Yeah, Andrew.
I get the sense that we're talking about personal evangelism.
Yep.
Primarily. What about our church's evangelism, like maybe a corporate body?
Yeah. Well, and that's actually what we're going to talk about. So I'm going to be introducing a topic. I'm calling it network evangelism. I'm going to be talking to you about the church's role in that, the elders' role in that, pastor's role in that, but also the individual member's role in that. And so you're at, again, we're all asking the right questions. If only we did a two-hour Sunday school, we'd get to everything that's going through our minds. But I like this. I like this because you guys are thinking very actively about this, which is exactly what I want. Well, let me pray for us and then dismiss. Father in heaven, I pray for everyone who's here today. Thank you that you have given us the good news, but thank you also that you have not given us the good news to keep for ourselves. Instead, you've given us the good news, which we are meant to share. And so I pray that you would make us more thoughtful, more enthusiastic. I pray that you would make us desirous to share Jesus with more people. Would you not only bring opportunities our way, but would you make us people who seek opportunities, that we are not just passive looking for ways that we can find someone to talk about, but that we are, and we're not waiting for them to come to us and fall into our laps, Lord. Those things may not ever happen if we're passive. Instead, help for us to be actively looking around and asking, Lord, who can I help? Who can I bless? Make us those people this week. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.